Next, we're very pleased to have with us, all the way from California, our mentor in the messaging world, and he will be with us in two sessions this during the day, and then this evening he will speak at the feed mill for dinner. And you can register at lunch. There's a few slots left, and first come, first serve registration during the lunch hour will get you access to that dinner tonight. George Lakoff.
How many of you would like to follow John Nichols as a speaker? Have any of you ever had a cold? I suspect a few of you have. I have one, so I'm going to be a little bit quieter than John, and maybe a little slower. So bear with me in case, because I have a little bit of a sore throat. First of all, thank you all for coming. When my wife asked me why I wanted to go to Wisconsin, I said, remember that protest in the Capitol when Walker did his thing? Remember all those people out there? That's why. I want to say something about me. I'm not a 10th generation American, I'm a second generation American. However, the first generation in my family, my brother and I, both the first generation in the history of our family to go to high school. Okay. My mother worked 25 years in a factory from the age of 12. Then she ran a rooming house for 17 years after that before retiring. So my father had to start working when he was 13 in a butcher store, then in later on in slaughterhouse, then took a night school course and worked for the General Accounting Agency, and during World War II was one of the major whistleblowers on the cheating of the American government by large corporations that he uncovered in the Government Accounting Agency.
Halliburton. Hmm? Halliburton.
Yeah, all those guys. So basically, I have a proud heritage. And I don't forget it. I'm here because you're here, and I want to start with a little. Again, we had Lisa told us a lot of the facts about the organization on the right. Do you know what the Leadership Institute is in Virginia? The Leadership Institute trains tens of thousands of conservatives a year to think and talk conservative. And they've been doing this for 30 to 40 years, and they're in 15 countries right now. This is not a small operation. This is part of the whole thing. They keep track of those guys. They're all over the country, and they have a booking agency to book them on radio shows, TV shows, and all sorts of venues every day. So it's not just Fox News. What you hear on Fox News is what's going out on computer to all these guys and going out through the booking agencies and all over the place. This is, you know, been known to the Democratic Party for a long time, done nothing about it. What's been going on with ALEC has been known since ALEC started, done nothing about it. They've just started ALICE, which is finally a reaction to that for progressive work at the local level. I just came back 2 weeks ago from talking to the Democratic municipal officials in Washington at their meeting, and also to the American Windmill Association at their meeting, and to the Democracy Initiative, which is another progressive initiative, which is another organization starting up there. We're finally getting organized, and it's about time. And I want to talk about what that means and the difference between material power and cognitive power, the power of the mind, and how that works. Because material power always depends upon cognitive power, and the right wing understands this thoroughly. And over the day, I'll go through this in very great detail. But first, I want to start with a little bit of very basic stuff. All politics is moral. Any political leader who gets up and says, do what I do, presumably is saying, because it's right. Nobody gets up and says, do what I do because it's wrong, because it's awful, it's terrible, but do it. Nobody says that. Nobody gets up there and says, do what I say because it doesn't matter. It's kind of random, but just do it. So that when you get political leaders saying opposite things, it's because they have opposite views of what's right and wrong. And that is extremely important, because the folks on the right understand their moral system. We have a moral system that we don't talk about. We talk about the facts. We talk about our history. We talk about the issues one by one. You know, all right. We don't talk about what unites them morally. And that is where we have to start. So that's one of the reasons I want to be here today. Because it turns out that when you think about all of those people in Clark County who are voting for your governor, all those people are not bad people. They're not bad people. They're people who have a different sense of what counts as moral. And they've heard that through the conservative communication system for the past 40 years. They've heard it over and over again. Now, why does that matter? It matters for the second reason, which is you think with your brains. You don't have a choice. All thought is physical. That's what I do. I'm a cognitive scientist and linguist. I study all of those things. And the way that this works is every thought you have is physically there in the neural system of your brain. It's in a neural circuit. And as a result, you can only understand what your physical brain allows you to understand. If you don't have the right neural circuitry, things go in one ear and out the other. And it turns out that people who have a very different view of what counts as moral have a different set of circuits in their brains. They will understand things very differently. In particular, they will understand the facts very differently. If the facts don't fit what's in their brains, they're not going to be heard. They're not going to be understood. They're going to be dismissed. So that is the first thing to understand. The second thing is we're going to go through the conservative moral system as well as the progressive one. And this is something not discussed in polite circles in politics. People don't go out and talk about the fact that there isn't one moral system going in the country. There are two opposing ones. But what is most interesting about that is that there are a lot of people, probably more than a third, who have parts of both systems in their brains, because we've been brought up by maybe different fathers and mothers, different communities. You know, we watch movies with both of those systems in them. You know, and what happens is that you get people who have both a conservative moral system and a progressive moral system, partly one or the other. What is a moderate? There is no ideology of the moderate. There's no general set of principles that all people who are moderates have. Doesn't happen. A moderate conservative is partly progressive on certain things. A moderate, progressive is partly conservative on various different things. There's no middle. There is no middle. What you have are people who are what I'll call bi-conceptual, who have both views about different things, mostly one, mostly the other, partly the other. And then the question is, how does that work? How is it possible in one brain to have two moral systems that contradict each other? Now, That this is true is very clear. Let me give you a very common non-political example. Imagine the moral systems on Saturday night and Sunday morning. Right? People don't even notice that there's a shift, but there is. And the way this works in brains is very simple. All through the brain, there are circuits called mutual inhibition, where one circuit inhibits the other. Whichever one is most active, the other is smaller. And if one is regularly activated over and over and over, the other is deactivated over and over. And the more that a neural circuit is activated in your brain, the stronger it gets. And if it is inhibiting the other, the weaker it gets. So that if one hears conservative language over and over and over, what's going to happen is, even if they have progressive thoughts, they're going to get weakened. And if progressives use the conservative language, they're shooting themselves in the foot. Namely, they're helping conservatives, and we'll go through that in detail, because that is happening here in Wisconsin and throughout the country. So that's part one. Part two has to do with what I'll call what are called frames. A frame is a very simple thing. Every thought you have uses a frame. Let me explain. Imagine a frame for a restaurant. Okay? What happens in a restaurant? You go to a restaurant, you expect certain things. You expect waiters, menus. You expect a chef to cook something. You expect dishes to be brought to you, a check afterwards, and so on. There are certain things that don't happen in restaurants, luckily. You go to a restaurant, you're not going to get a herd of elephants coming through, hopefully. You go to a restaurant and they're not going to wheel in a patient to be operated on in front of you, right? Those are for hospitals, and in a different frame. Everything you understand about any social institution or structure, or physical structure, is structured in terms of frames which have things like waiters and chefs, which are called semantic roles, and scenarios that you can count on to happen. Those are normal. You can't think about anything. You can't think about anything without a frame. And what my late colleague who died last month, Charles Fillmore, discovered back in 1975, is that every word in every language of the world is defined relative to these neural frames, to these frames in your brain. And whenever you have a word and you say that word, some frame is activated in your brain. It's going to be stronger. If that word is said over and over, that's going to matter. Now, Chuck Fillmore taught me something very deep about this back in 1977. Chuck, we went to coffee one day in Berkeley, and Chuck said, there's a trial going on in Boston that's just ended. And a doctor who performed an abortion was on trial for murder. And in that trial, the prosecuting attorney used the word baby, and the defense attorney used the word fetus. And that's what the trial was about. That is, whichever frame dominates wins. Right? Remember that. It's everywhere. When I was first asked to speak to a retreat of the Democrats in the U.S. Senate, I was asked to explain what a frame was. And I gave a simple example. This was back in 2003. I said, when George Bush first came into office, on his first day, he used the expression tax relief. And on the second day, and the third day, and every day after that for months, was written in every speech he gave. And if you think about it, the word relief has a frame. It says, there's some affliction that you have, and it requires being taken away. It's a bad thing, it harms you. And if someone gives you relief, they're a hero, they're a good guy. And if someone tries to stop them from relieving that affliction, they're bad people. And you have tax relief says, by a metaphor, that taxation is an affliction. That's a conservative metaphor that's in there. And when you hear it over and over again, you're getting that conservative worldview. Why? Because all politics is moral. And there is a conservative worldview, and the frames are structured hierarchically. something Fillmore discovered. And in politics, the highest part of the hierarchy is political morality. Whether you're progressive or conservative, there's a certain moral view that you have, and all frames fit that moral view. And when you activate that frame, you activate the entire moral view and all the other related frames. That is, issues are not isolated. They all come together behind single moral positions. And so what we're going to do is talk about what those moral positions are, how they work, and why you shouldn't just be thinking of one issue and another issue and another issue as if voting rights were separate from fracking, as if fracking were separate from education and so on. They're all part of one thing, the way you understand what this country is about. And we're going to get into that in detail because it has to do with a moral view that we have about the country. Now, the next thing that's really important to think about is this. What is it that unites all the particular issues that conservatives support? This is a question I asked in 1994 when I read a book called The Contract with America, written by Frank Luntz. Some of you will remember that book. I have a lot of civic duty. Every year I watch the Republican National Convention out of civic duty. In fact, in 1992, I was sitting in my living room watching it, and I particularly wanted to hear Dan Quayle's acceptance speech. Some of you will remember this vice president who is not one of our stellar vice presidents. But I wanted to hear a speech because it was written by William Crystal, who is a major theorist on the right. And in that speech, as I listened to it, I realized that I didn't understand Dan Quayle. I understood every word and every sentence. I had no idea how these sentences fit together. But I realized that it wasn't Quayle, it was William Crystal writing this speech. So I said, something must be going on here. So I said, okay, I'm a linguist, I'm going to remember an example. Okay, here was the example I committed to memory. It was Dan Quayle's argument against the progressive income tax, and it was a one-sentence argument. Now, how do you argue against the progressive income tax in one sentence if you're a Republican at the convention? Here's the sentence. Why should the best people be punished? And they all, you know, cheer and wave their signs. And I'm sitting there saying, why is this an argument against the progressive income tax? Now, I'm going to remember this, okay? Now, it became a little clearer in 1994 when the Contract with America came out. And I read it and I said, these are very weird people. What does being against abortion have to do with the flat tax? What does the flat tax have to do with owning guns? What does owning guns have to do with getting rid of environmental legislation? What does that have to do with tort reform? I just didn't get it. And I said, but this is not just an ordinary person saying this. I'm a professor at Berkeley in cognitive science. This is my field. I'm supposed to know this. So I said, okay, I'm going to take this as an academic challenge. I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to just do the research as a cognitive science problem. And so what I did was I read lots of speeches, I read news reports, I read books, everything I could get my hand on. I interviewed people person after person. For 6 months I got nowhere until I remembered a homework problem from one of my undergraduates. A young woman pointed out that we have a metaphor. By the way, I'm the guy who figured out how metaphorical thought works and what the math behind that is. It's my job. Okay, it's my day job. And so I said, okay. She pointed out we have a metaphor that the nation is a family. We have founding fathers. We send our sons and daughters to war. We have homeland security and so on and so on. And he said, okay, if we have this metaphor about the nation, if we have two different views of the nation, maybe they're based on two different views of the family. So I set up the metaphors mathematically and worked backwards, right? A standard tradition in science. We all work backwards. That's actually how science gets done. It's reverse engineering. And out popped two different views of the family, a strict father view and a nurturing parent view. And you know which is which. And I went off, and we'll go through that in some detail, but I went off to a conference of cognitive linguists. There were 500 cognitive linguists in a single room in New Mexico. And way up in the corner, there were two guys who were talking to each other throughout my talk, who were whispering, who were old friends of mine. They were members of the Christian Coalition. I have friends who are members of the Christian Coalition. They're Bible translators who are terrific linguists and very nice folks. And so afterwards, when we were having a party and I was drinking a beer and they weren't, you know, I went up and said hello, and they said, hey, you know what about this strict father stuff you said? It's sort of right. We have to correct a couple of details here and there. You know, it's there, but you got to get it. We want you to get it right. But you should know all this. Don't you read Dobson? Well, this is 1995. I'm saying, who's Dobson? And they say, you must live in Berkeley. James Dobson, he's on more radio shows than more radio stations than anyone else and more newspapers than anyone else. He's got so many people writing for his materials, he needs his own zip code, and he hires so many people, he's got his own freeway exit. One of my students, when I mentioned this, signed me up for 3 years of his materials. Now, they said, you know, you should really go and read his classic book, Dare to Discipline. Right? I said, oh, great, where do I find this? In your local Christian bookstore, they said. I said, well, I live in Berkeley. They said, even in Berkeley, walk down Telegraph Avenue, cross White Way, turn right, and you will see the Jews for Jesus bookstore. Oh. So when I got back, I put on my dark glasses and my trench coat in midsummer, walked down into the Jews for Jesus bookstore carrying a brown bag, so I had a plain brown wrapper. And there in the back shelf was the new Dare to Discipline and lots of other conservative child-rearing books, all of which spelled out in detail the strict father family. And Dobson spelled out not only the parenting model, but all the applications to politics and foreign policy and economics and religion and everything else. He had it all written down there. I had figured it out. It took me months and months to figure this stuff out, and he had already figured it out for the conservatives. And other conservatives had figured it out. Now, what's interesting about this is the following, and it goes like this. In a strict father family, the father is the leader of the family, the boss, the major authority. There's no authority over the father in the family. The father knows right from wrong. And the assumption is kids are born bad in the following sense, that they don't know right from wrong yet, that they just do what feels good. You've heard the term feel-good liberalism? What that means to conservatives is liberals have not been taught right. They haven't been taught the right morality by their parents. They haven't been punished when they did things wrong. They've just been allowed to do what feels good. So you can't allow that. Strict father family has to punish his child lovingly because that's called tough love, often physically, so that the child will learn to do what the father says, which is always correct and right, and learn morality and not do bad things, not just do what feels good. Then they will learn discipline, and there's a logic to that, which is if you learn discipline, then you can go out into a free market world, get fiscal discipline, and then become prosperous. So, what happens if someone's not prosperous? Guess why? They have no discipline. Well, then they can't be moral, so they deserve their poverty. But maybe they should be taught a lesson, right? To have everything taken away so that they will get more discipline, right? That's why, because they deserve punishment. Got it? You've heard this argument directly out of this, and you hear it over and over from your governor and lots of other folks, most recently from Paul Ryan this week. Now, there are other parts of the strict father family structure that's very, very important. One of them says, of course, there should be no authority higher than the father. We'll see that that's very important in many cases. So that the authority must be maintained at all costs. Secondly, there's an assumption that this is natural and right and moral. That, you know, that the father is naturally the leader of the family, being male, and that this is a moral thing to do because he knows right from wrong and is teaching his kids morality, making sure that the family does things right. So it's a moral thing to do. And that assumes that power and morality should fit together. That the people who rule should be the most moral people. Well, how do you know? Well, in a well-ordered world, ordered by God, there's a hierarchy, okay? You look at what has happened. You have God above man, man above nature. Nature is there for you to use any way you want, right? So man above nature, adults above children. Children are there to be, you know, beaten if necessary and raised properly and corrected and so on and tested and so on. So there are, you know, adults above children. Western culture above non-Western culture. Our country above other countries. And most conservatives will buy that much. And then the hierarchy goes further, which is not true of all conservatives, but many. You have men above women, Christians above non-Christians, straights above gays, whites above non-whites. That is, all of those things are part of the same hierarchy. There's a reason for all those things fitting together. Now, what I did when I wrote Moral Politics back in 96 as a result of this was to point out that all of those positions of conservatives make sense. And when I had to do my view of this, I said, well, you know, how do mine fit together? That was based on what I'll call a nurturing parent family, which is actually, by the way, when I got into this, I went over to the Institute for Human Development at Berkeley, which studies parenting and child development, and found out that these family structures had been discovered and discussed in great detail. We can talk about that. I talked about that in Moral Politics. This is not something that just happened to come out in my research. People who did the research had found the same things. Now, the nurturing parent family goes like this. It says, if you have two parents, they have equal authority. And their job is to empathize with their children, to notice what their children need, to fit in their shoes, to see, you know, if they're crying, why they're crying, what this is about. And their job is to maintain two-way communication. It's not, shut up and listen. It's tell me what's going on, and I'm gonna tell you what's going on. If I have to protect my child, I have to tell them why I'm doing it. You know, I don't just say, do it, period. Right? So you explain it first. Then, in addition to that, your job is to nurture your child, to be fulfilled, and to be able to take care of themselves and others. That is, personal responsibility and social responsibility go together there. You raise your child to be responsible to their family, to their community, to their country, and for themselves at the same time. And you raise them to be fulfilled maximally in their lives. That's what a nurturing parent does. They're very different. Now, Barack Obama in 2008 understood this very well. And these ideas actually showed up in his speeches in 2008. And if you want to see the best example of this, you can go to a speech that is almost never cited in the press. It's his Father's Day speech in 2008, where he's talking to an African-American church in Chicago about and addressing young men who have father children and are not raising them. And he says, "You're not a real man if you're doing that. A real man takes responsibility for his family and for others and for people in his community. You want to be a man, you have to be responsible. Go and join your family, but you're not in charge because the mother of those children know better than you do because they've been raising them. Your job is to empathize with them, take care of them, make sure that they care about others, because if you're not teaching empathy, then you're going to get a generation of people who don't care about each other." He says, "You can't have that. And the other thing you need is to acquire a sense of quality, of an ethic of excellence," is what he called it. That is, you want to raise your children to be the best they can to be fulfilled in their lives. And you want to do the same. Start doing it yourself. Okay? And then he said, "Government works exactly the same way." And he spelled it out. Look up, great speech. Now, he didn't continue that in many cases. He continued talking about empathy. He has over 80 speeches on that. And if you go to a website called The Culture of Empathy, you'll see those speeches. They're out there. When did Obama stop talking about empathy? During the Sotomayor nomination case, when he said a Supreme Court justice requires empathy. And he was jumped on by conservatives who didn't know what empathy was. They thought he meant sympathy. They thought he meant, you know, you should be favoring other people. And so because that was misunderstood, instead of coming out the next day and saying, "No, I meant empathy, and here's what empathy is, and here's why it should be in every Supreme Court justice," he stopped. Because he was attacked for doing it. And he's done that a number of times, which is a terrible shame. Now, these differences in family models turn out to be applied in every area of life. And I have a book on that called Whose Freedom? Inspired by George W. Bush. In his second inaugural address, he used the words free, freedom, and liberty 49 times in 20 minutes. And more than half of those were not anything I would recognize as freedom at all. And the reason was he has a strict father view, and freedom is a contested concept. It means something different to conservatives and liberals. And conservatives are taking over the words freedom and liberty constantly. And what I'm going to be arguing and talking about is it's time to take them back. Freedom is important, it's central in democracy, and we can take it back, and it's central to every issue that is going on in this state. So there's a reason for a Wisconsin Freedom Campaign. We'll go into those reasons in detail. But very, very important to see that. Now, when you understand one more thing, let me ask you a question. When were you first governed? In your family.
Yeah, sure.
Right? You learned that a governing institution is a family. You learned it in your brains. That's how metaphors are formed very early. And then that gets applied to all governing institutions, whether they're churches, classrooms, teams, or political parties, or the government. It gets applied throughout, including institutions like the market. And I want to talk about that next. There's a reason why conservatives and progressives think absolutely differently about the market. And it goes like this. You've heard the expression, "let the market decide." Right? Well, I'm a linguist. I say, okay, the verb decide usually takes a subject that is not the market. It's usually an animate subject, and a decider, as George Bush famously said. Well, why is the market a decider? What does that mean? The market is seen as being like the strict father, you know, natural on the assumption that all people are naturally greedy, moral on the conservative assumption of the invisible hand metaphor, that is, if everybody pursues their own profit, the profit of all will be maximized, and that's moral. That's the conservative version of Adam Smith. And then it's assumed that the market is going to reward those with fiscal discipline and punish those without it. But most important is there should be no authority higher than the market. The market's the strict father, no authority higher. What does that mean? It means no government regulation, no taxation, no worker rights, no unions, no tort cases, and no view of science that contradicts the market. Okay? Think of what this explains. All of those things fit together. They make sense to conservatives to have those positions. They're the same position. They're not different positions for conservatives. And that's important to understand. And there is a progressive view of the market that's very different. It says, you know, yeah, businesses are fine. You know, if you want to start a bakery and bake good bread, wonderful. We have good bread out in Wisconsin these days. You want to make good cheeses? Fantastic. You want to make a living making good cheeses? Wonderful, because good cheeses are good for people. Good beer, better beer, the better. You know, terrific, great. You know, that's wonderful. You know, do things that are responsible to the public, that make life better for people, you know, and allow you to live, and well, not only that, any money you spend, we help other people, you know, who are in business, and most people, you know, are in business doing something or other, unless they're working for the state. If they're working for the state, they're working for everybody. So the question is, how do people help everybody? You know, that's a very different view of the market. And it says, how are people going to be protected in these cases? Well, you do have to have, you know, regulation and taxation and all these things. So very, very different view of the market and of everything else. Now, that says something important, that issues fit together. They're not separate. They come together around these moral worldviews. Now, a few little linguistic facts. One of the first things I learned when I started teaching about framing was that if you negate a frame, you activate the frame. Right? You reinforce the frame. How? Okay? Richard Nixon said, "I am not a crook." Made you think of him as a crook. I wrote a book called Don't Think of an Elephant for just that reason, right? You think of an elephant. Chris Kiske got it wrong recently. That was good when he said, "I am not a bully." And, you know, but when you go out and deny this, you know, you get democratic mistakes. You know, Barack Obama said, "This is not a government takeover." Saying government takeover over again, making people think of government takeovers. Right? And that is a problem, that Democrats don't understand how that works. It's important to know the first thing. If you use the other guy's language, even to negate it, you're helping him. If you use their arguments, even to argue against it and say, "Oh, here is what Glenn Beck said today, A, B, C. Here is his argument, and here are the facts against it. This one goes against this point in his argument. This one goes against that point in his argument." You're repeating all the points of his argument, right? Just watch MSNBC any night. Okay. Now, the question is, why the Democrats do this, and why do they get it wrong? And let me go through one more thing about it before I do that. Why was it that President Obama, after getting through the Affordable Care Act, basically allowed the conservatives to knock it down right after he got it through? What happened in 2009? Okay? Now, when Obama got elected, before he became president, I happened to be talking on my cell phone with a friend who was his pollster. And he was taking a poll of possible ideas to go into the Affordable Care Act. And he said, you know, the president wanted, you know, the most popular positions that were worthwhile that he could get. And he got them. Every single position that's in there was approved 60% to 80% and still is. You know, no preconditions, you know, about 80%. You start asking people, you know, should you have preconditions on it? You know, should somebody who's pregnant not be able to get insurance? Well, hell no, you know. All right, et cetera. So that's one, and so on. Should your child be, you know, when they go to college, can they stay on your health care plan? You know, 80%. You know, it's still that way. You go down the list of positions, 60 to 80% on every single one. How did the conservatives get the total plan to be less than that, to be under 50%? What did they do? Right, first, what they did not do. No conservative ever argued against those positions. You never heard a conservative go out and say, yes, you should have preconditions. No, your kid shouldn't be on your insurance. None of them ever did that. They were too smart. They were told, very astutely by Frank Luntz, to go moral. Moral on two principles. What were they? Freedom and life. It's a government takeover of death panels, government takeover of death panels, repeated over and over again. Morality is in one part of the brain. Practical health issues are in a different part of the brain. They went to another part of the brain and they attacked it there. And they called it Obamacare, making Obama the issue. Now, I don't know, how many of you saw this wonderful Jimmy Kimmel interview? Have you seen that show? There was a marvelous thing where Jimmy Kimmel sent one of his guys out to do a man in the street interview in Los Angeles. Right? And he says, you know, got people, which do you think is better, Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act? And one after another, people would say, I don't know about Obamacare, it sounds really bad. The Affordable Care Act is great. And of course, Obama chose Obamacare on the grounds that it said Obama cares, which it doesn't. Not understanding the linguistics of it. And of course, they had no linguists in the White House at the time. I mean, that's a problem. Well, actually, they did, but she was a student of mine working down the hall on the communications team, who, and they were never able to get any information back through Rahm Emanuel. But anyway, they did have a linguist who understood all this stuff, 50 feet from the president, unable to communicate. That's not great. So the general point is, here you have Barack Obama, one of our greatest speech makers and communicators, not communicating what he needs to communicate. Why is this happening? Why haven't the Democrats set up a communication system that matches the conservatives' ones? They've known about ALEC, you know, since like 2003. They've known about all of this stuff for years and years and years, and they have not acted. Why? Well, there's a very simple reason. They went to college. I'm serious. If you're a conservative and you're going to college, what are you studying? You're probably studying some business, right? In the business curriculum, there's a course called marketing. Okay? What do marketing professors study? Cognitive science. They study how people think in terms of frames, metaphors, images, narratives, emotions, and so on. They study how to market their ideas. When progressives go to college, what do they study?
Liberal arts,
political science, economics, law, public policy. They don't study marketing or cognitive science. They don't study how people really think. Instead, they learn a different theory of reason, a theory of reason that was made up in 1650 by René Descartes. Wonderful, very important idea in the Enlightenment. In the Enlightenment, the idea got across that we are all rational, that we all are rational animals, and that we therefore, since we can all think, we don't have to let the church or kings or nobles think for us. We can think for ourselves. In 1650, this was a radical, a very important idea. Now, Descartes, being a mathematician, had the following views on what it was. He said, I think, therefore I am, because he said, all thought is conscious. Well, we now know from neuroscience and cognitive science that about 98% of thought is unconscious. Consciousness is like 2%. Why? It has to be that way. Why? Because in your brain, the brain circuits work in parallel. They spread out by the hundreds. Consciousness is linear. You could not consciously follow all your thought. It's impossible. Couldn't be done physically. So part of your brain is conscious, a very important part. It's very important to be conscious. That's good. But remember, it's 98% unconscious. Secondly, Descartes said reason is logic. It's not. It has to do with frames, metaphors, etc. All of those things. Third, Descartes said emotion gets in the way of reason. And sometimes it does, as you probably know. But what is discovered by Antonio Damasio, one of our greatest neuroscientists, in a book called Descartes' Error, that if you have a brain injury or stroke that keeps you from feeling emotion, you don't know whether you like or don't like anything. And if you don't, if like and not like mean nothing to you, you cannot set a goal and you cannot rationally pursue it. You cannot tell if someone else will like or not like what you do, so you act randomly and screw up your life. Right? You must have emotion in order to be rational, in order to reason. You must, to set goals. Language, Descartes said, just fits the world. It's neutral. How do our concepts and language fit the world? He had an answer to this. God wouldn't lie to us. Not a good enough answer. It fits the world because thought goes through the body and through the brain, and you can only understand what your body and brain allow you to understand. So that's a very big deal. In short, people most of the Democratic political leaders, most of the Democratic policymakers, staff members, etc., and reporters, were trained in that view of reason, and it doesn't work. The conservative strategists were trained in a different view of reason that they've been using successfully. And we have to go beyond that. It's not that it's wrong. There's a thing that follows from Descartes. If you tell people the facts, they'll always reason to the right conclusion because everybody is rational and thinks the right way. So what we should do is just get the facts out there. More facts, more facts, more facts and figures. Facts, facts, facts. Doesn't work. They've been doing this for years. They keep saying, let's get the facts out there. Facts are important, but the moral basis of those facts, the moral meaning of those facts, is what is really important. And that's what we're going to get at today. So, let's see. I probably talked long enough. Just about, if you have to get to something. And we'll be doing lots more detail as we go through. We're going to talk about unions, we're going to talk about fracking and sand mining and iron mining and education and any issue you want to bring up. Let's go.